Hello, I'm Daniel Simpson, the host of Ancient Futures. If you're hearing this, you're listening to a preview of an archived podcast. For the full conversation, go to ancientfutures.substack.com, the link is in the show notes, and become a paid subscriber. Or you can also sign up for a free 7-day trial with no obligation. If you already subscribe, however, you have access to everything via the website, where you can go to your account page to set up a feed to your favourite podcast app. Just follow the instructions at ancientfutures.substack.com/account. Now, everything is free at the time of release, so it's also possible to subscribe without any charge to get the latest episodes direct to your inbox, along with other interviews and things that I write. All of that does take time to produce, though, so while it's a labour of love, subscriber donations do help make it sustainable. But if you're not in a position to pay, just send me a message and we'll work something out. For now, on with the preview. Hello and welcome to Ancient Futures, where time hits the snooze button and I take a break. This week I'm on holiday, but I'll share a conversation and an update on plans. It's been a busy year, with lots of surprises, including this podcast. When I started back in March, it was really an experiment, but one that I've been enjoying. And so I plan to continue next year with this twice monthly schedule, a podcast every couple of weeks, and as a result, we're already up to number 22. Before I got started, though, for real, I had a few chats with people that I was posting on YouTube. And the one I'm going to share today is one I'm keen to revisit. Now, if you're listening to this on a podcast app rather than the Substack website where it's all hosted, I encourage you to go to Substack and have a look at what's there as well, because every other week when I'm not sharing a podcast, I post some writing, interviews and other materials there. So if you visit Substack and subscribe, you get those emailed to your inbox. And I mention that because last week's essay has lots of overlaps with this conversation that I'm going to share with Graham Burns. Now, I met Graham at SOAS in London, where he used to contribute to the MA in yoga studies. And I signed up for that 10 years ago, which led to me getting more and more immersed in yoga history and philosophy, writing a book called The Truth of Yoga, and now I teach there, which I'd never have imagined I'd be doing at the start of this year, never mind when I was studying there. So when I spoke to Graham back in February, I was feeling somewhat distant from the academic world, and I explored that in the essay that I posted on Wednesday. So you might want to read that before diving in if you haven't already, and you can find that along with everything else podcast related and otherwise at ancientfutures.substack.com. Now, Graham and I get into detail about some of what I talked about in that essay, the tensions between practicing yoga and studying its history and philosophy in a scholarly way. And it's not easy to summarise that without being flippant. I might, if I was to suggest that Patanjali, the author of the Yoga Sutra, was basically telling us all to sit down and shut up and not get lost in intellectualising. Thankfully, we go a bit further than that in this conversation, so there'll be lots to dive into, and I can't really do that justice. You'll have to tune in. Just to tell you a little bit more about Graham, he's been teaching yoga for more than 20 years, as well as getting into academic study and writing a PhD on the Upanishads. To cut a long story short, we're basically trying to figure out the difference between practitioners who do a bit of studying and being an academic who dabbles in practice, because really, in essence, they ask different questions and they do speak different languages, but there is still a way to harmonise them, as Graham has explored for himself and as I'm now discovering for myself. But before we get into that, as a couple of other things I just quickly want to share. If you have been enjoying the podcast, please do go to the Substack website and take a look, and consider becoming a paid subscriber. If you do that, the donation that you make is really going to make a difference to me because I love what I do, but it takes time. And because I don't really have a regular job, that's time that I don't spend on work that I get paid for. So there's a limit to how much of it I can do. And I'm committed to continuing. So I will be making a few changes next year to provide a few extra perks to tempt subscribers. So now's a very good time to get in while you can. And before the rush, so to speak. At the same time, if you're moved by the spirit of Christmas, you can also offer someone else a gift subscription. So the address for all that is ancientfutures.substack.com. And if you want to find out more about other things I'm up to, my teaching, workshops and retreats, a monthly men's group as well that I've been running, that will also be continuing next year, find out more at danielsimpson.info. For now, though, enough of all of that. Let's stop talking Santa and say a bit of bah humbug to yoga scholarship. Well, not really, but let's think a little bit critically about critical thinking, because there are limits to how useful it can be. So here goes with that exploration in this conversation I had with Graham Burns. So, welcome, Graham. We met quite a few years ago now at SOAS, where you were teaching, I was studying, and we both therefore have dipped our toe into the world of yoga studies academically, as well as from the perspective of being teachers and practitioners. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about your own academic background. What motivated you to go all the way and do a PhD?
All the way. Yeah, all counted all the way. But yeah, thanks, Daniel. It's a pleasure to chat with you about this. I don't know how much you know. I mean, I spent quite a bit of my life working as a commercial lawyer in the City of London. And I got increasingly fed up with that for all sorts of reasons we don't need to talk about now. And I eventually got out of that world at the beginning of 2004. I was already teaching yoga at that point. I'd been teaching yoga for a few years. And I guess what sort of happened was that I realized not very long after leaving the legal profession that teaching yoga, just teaching regular yoga classes, wasn't providing me with the intellectual stimulation that I was getting from being a lawyer, for better or for worse. So I started off, I took some evening courses. There was a time when Birkbeck, part of London University, they may still do this, I don't know, but they were offering quite a lot of interesting evening courses. So I took one on Indian philosophy. I took another one on Buddhism. In the early 2000s, I think this was even before I left the legal profession, so it was like 2003, something like that. And on one of those Birkbeck courses, I met somebody who had been to SOAS, and she'd done a BA in religions at SOAS. And we were chatting one night in the pub after one of the lectures, as one tended to do in those days. And she said, you should go to SOAS, you should go and do the MA in religion. And I sort of thought, my initial reaction was, why would I want to do that? And then I thought, okay, maybe this is something I should investigate. So I started exploring a little bit what that would involve. And I got as far as really getting ready, getting the application form and all the paperwork ready to send in. And then I got cold feet and decided not to do it. I then went on a yoga holiday. I was in Greece and I got chatting to somebody I know in the yoga world and talking about how I thought about doing this and then decided not to and so on. And he said, oh, but you should do it. You've really got to do it. I don't know why he said this, but he did. And so basically, to cut the long story short, I applied a year later than I'd initially intended to. And one of the results of doing that was that my very first lecturer at SOAS was the guy who taught those Birkbeck courses.
Oh, wow.
Back in the early 2000s. And as things were developed, he became one of my PhD examiners. And we got on quite well. And so, yeah, I did the MA in, it was technically MA in religions, but my focus was very much on Indian religions. And of course, with my sort of yoga teacher hat on, that was playing a part in that. So yeah, I got my MA. Somebody else at SOAS, another lecturer at SOAS, said, well, you know, are you going to come back and do a PhD? And I said, no, I don't think so. and then again, I was traveling. Why do these things happen when you're traveling? I don't know, but I was traveling.
Three connecting threads, traveling, PhDs and yoga practice. They're all roads to nowhere, aren't they, in some way?
I guess that's probably right, yeah. And I was traveling and I started thinking about this a little bit more and what I might do a PhD on if I chose to do it. And so long story short, I did go back to SOAS a year or two later and embarked on a PhD part-time, which finally came around. I finally finished that in 2018. Wow. So that's my, and then I suppose the other academic side of that, you talked about where we first met. I, as is quite often the case, when one is working on a PhD, one gets asked to do some teaching. And particularly also because of my yoga teaching background and also that I've been involved in training yoga teachers, I was asked to stand in for somebody who was on sabbatical on the MA in Traditions of Yoga and Meditation, which by this time SOAS had set up. And that was where, of course, where we met, though a year or two later. So I did some teaching at SOAS on that. I taught some undergraduate Hinduism at SOAS. I taught some other sort of bits of comparative philosophy at SOAS up until about, I don't know, a year or two ago, I guess, when I stopped.
And then at the same time, you know, obviously you obviously had to have quite a lot of commitment to stick at it over all those years, but didn't want to turn it into an academic career, it seems. You've, I guess,
correct,
still got some of, you know, a foothold in that world through having the PhD. You could, should you choose, you know, turn that into something. But I'm curious as to why you didn't want an academic career.
I guess there are a number of reasons. One is that I think I'm probably too old anyway to embark on an academic career from scratch, which is effectively what it would be. So that was one very practical reason. I also didn't want to recommit myself to a full-time job, which probably would have meant giving up my yoga or some of my yoga teaching and teacher training that I do. So I didn't really want to commit to that. And I also felt I didn't really want to get sucked into the academic world in too much depth.
Why not? What's
That sounds awful. I found that it could be quite bureaucratic, and I'm, you know, coming from a background, or admittedly from a very large law firm that I worked for. In many ways, one of the reasons I wanted to get away from the law was that I didn't want to get sucked up into more administrative, bureaucratic type functions, and I could see how easily that can happen in an academic role, and I that just didn't interest me. So in the same way as one of the reasons I got out from being a lawyer was because I actually wanted to be a lawyer, if that makes any sort of sense, rather than a marketing person or an admin person or whatever. So I guess one of the reasons I didn't want to go ahead into an academic career, even if age hadn't been a factor, was I didn't really want to get sucked into the organization, if you like, in that same way.
Yeah, so people perhaps don't realize necessarily, if they've not been too involved in that world, that you know the two main things that people associate with academics are researching and teaching, and they don't get much of a look in a lot of the time. And the teaching is probably lowest on the rung of importance. It's much more about research work and bringing money into the institutions through gaining prominence.
I think there's a lot of that, and that was a sort of pressure that I didn't really feel I wanted. And also I could see the workload that involves for a lot of people, which again is not a road I particularly wanted to go down. I had a friend, actually a yoga student, several years ago, who was actually quite a high-flying academic at another institution in London. And I was just aware of how much work she had to do to stay on top of her research, her teaching, her role as she's now a full professor in the institution and her role. And I thought, I've got out of that life a little bit, out of the rat race and off the hamster wheel. I'm not sure I'm going to go back onto a different one.
Well, it's very interesting that you put it in those terms because, obviously the academic world, like any other, can be institutionalized, competitive, and corporate to a certain extent. But the whole idea of yoga studies would seem to be to try and bring some of the yoga into the studies. And you obviously did that in the subject you chose for your PhD, focusing on the Upanishads. But I wonder why there isn't quite so much yoga in the studies aspect of the world of yoga academia.
I suppose I throw that back at you and say, what do you mean by not much yoga in it? We both know how broad a term yoga is.
let's define it a bit more specifically then. In the world of researching the history and philosophy of yoga, for the most part, there's a lot of dry analysis involved, and the perspective of the practitioner is not brought to the fore, except perhaps in a sort of participant observation, ethnographic kind of a way. There isn't really an interest in that experience. And the whole path of yoga is about direct experience. Mm. So the further you go with the academic analysis, the less of a look in that might get. And the more one gets involved in the promotion of one's reputation in order to stay afloat in the competitive academic world. So it's quite hard to maintain a detached mindset in that environment. That's what I meant, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, but I think the whole world. I mean, you use the term yoga studies, which I think most people would acknowledge is a relatively new sort of discipline in its own right. Mm. But until really relatively few years ago, yoga studies, or the study of yoga, I should say, perhaps in the academic environment, it tended to sit in a religious studies department, or maybe a philosophy department. Maybe there were some historians were looking at it, some ethnographers were looking at it. And when I, when I first started my time at SOAS, it was way before, or certainly a few years before, this whole idea of yoga studies had really taken off. Mm. And before SOAS had established its MA course in traditions of yoga and meditation. And something I actually became very conscious of quite early on when I was doing my research around yoga things for my part of my MA course. Mm. I was thinking, who are these people who are writing all these learned articles about yoga? Mm. And something that was very obvious to me was that I had no way of knowing whether any of these people were actually practitioners of yoga or not. They may very well have been, but they didn't emphasize that in their writing. They didn't emphasize that in the way they put themselves forward. They weren't people whose names I recognized from the non-academic yoga world, if that makes sense. Mm. So I was actually quite conscious early on of what, on the face of it anyway, appeared to be a distinction between the people who were studying and writing about yoga from an academic perspective, whether that was historically, ethnographically, or whatever, and people who were sort of practicing yoga on the ground, if you will. And absolutely, there were overlaps. You know, absolutely, I have some very good friends who are very serious yoga practitioners who I know are also scholars in their own right, in their own field. But it seemed at that stage, anyway, as if, you know, the two didn't really quite meet, if that makes any sort of sense. And, you know, I think that's changed. And in this world that we now call yoga studies that's developed, and I think SOAS has played a hugely important part in developing that as a discipline. You know, I think we do now start to see people who are clearly scholars in the academic sense, but also are clearly practitioners and in some cases teachers of yoga. Mm. So I suppose the question that then perhaps starts to raise its head is which takes priority? Does one of them take priority, or do the two somehow successfully manage to inform each other?
It's an excellent question. There's a phrase for those listening who perhaps aren't so sort of enmeshed in this world that does the rounds these days, the scholar practitioner. You know, the emphasis there is immediately, it's compounds, Sanskrit puts together. But in the English language, you've got there at the beginning, the emphasis on scholar, a scholar who's a practitioner rather than a practitioner who dabbles in scholarship. So yeah, it does seem
it that way around.
but obviously Sanskrit compounds are more open to interpretation, but in that specific context, it does seem, you know, very clear to me that the front loading of scholar tells you where the emphasis is, and the sort of, you know, general, even amongst those who are quite openly practitioners, not drawing attention to one's practitioner status. And I suppose the sort of classic example of this that I've come across through my own reading and then through my own teaching, and people are almost being surprised to discover it, is Mark Singleton's book Yoga Body, which mm-hmm. doesn't begin with a sort of positionality statement that I teach and practice Hatha yoga in various forms and have done for quite a while now, and that was sort of accompanying my research into these topics. I mean, he did write an article for Yoga Journal that sort of alluded to that, but that would have not been necessary information in his PhD, and it didn't seem like the thing to draw attention to in a book that was all about analysis. But it made it harder for practitioners to relate to what he was talking about. I think
I think Mark Singleton is a great example of somebody who, as you and I both know, was absolutely a yoga practitioner, and indeed, as I understand it, a trained yoga teacher.
Indeed, yeah. In several schools, I think.
In several schools before he embarked on the academic study that eventually led to that book, Yoga Body. And I don't know, and you suggest that it wasn't necessary for him to allude to that in his PhD work. I don't know. I mean, I don't know to what extent it would have changed anything if he had, in terms of how his work was received at an academic level, for better or for worse.
That's a really good point. I had just assumed that, you know, based on the fact that people weren't advertising their practitioner kind of subset, that it would have been better to leave it out. But it might therefore actually, had you put it in, have suggested that this was all motivated by, you know, some other kind of inclination than objective rational analysis. It mm-hmm. might have been defending a particular lineage's point of view, and so on and so forth.
I can see that argument too. And I don't know what the answer would be. And I think the answer may well actually, if we're honest about that, might depend very much on the institution and all the particular supervisors and examiners involved, and how they relate to that sort of, it's not really a dichotomy, but you know what I mean, that sort of dual role of being the scholar and the practitioner.
Well, there is a tension, I think, somehow. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
But I'm curious what might happen if we turn the compound round then, if it was the practitioner scholar, would something else happen?
Well, I think this is something which I think is actually...
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to this preview. To continue listening and to get access to all archived episodes along with other perks, visit ancientfutures.substack.com.